Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Ihis Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
It's thought that two bombs went off and a third one did not detonate. So right now the authorities are looking at the possibility that perhaps all three were meant to be suicide bombers, but the third one, his bomb didn't go off and he may be on the loose.
Now, they did find the third bomb, did they not, and detonated at the airport?
Yes, the authorities discovered the undetonated bomb at the airport after the blast, and they detonated it in a controlled explosion.
That's reporter David Keating with details on the terrorist bombing at Brussels airport today. One of two such attacks in the Belgian capital. Details coming up.
Also, partial results from Niger's presidential runoff election show incumbent Mahamadou Issoufou heading for a landslide victory, and the deal between the European Union and Turkey to control the flow of migrants and refugees into Europe continues to encounter problems.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, two explosions rocked Brussels today, leaving at about 34 people dead and up to 200 injured. News agencies are reported that Islamic State has claiming responsibility. The blast occurred at Brussels Airport and the subway system. It's believed one of the explosions was the result of a suicide bomber. Today's attacks come just a few days after Belgian authorities arrested Salah Abdeslam, the prime suspect in last November's terrorist attacks in Paris that left more than 100 people dead. Reporter Dave Keating is in Brussels. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle about two people who were on a train close to where the bomb went off.
One guy, he's a lobbyist here in Brussels. He was on the train. He was in the car just behind the one where the bomb exploded. So there was all of a sudden a big, loud noise. Everyone kind of fell to the floor and the lights went off. And there was a lot of kind of screaming and yelling, as you would imagine. There was a lot of smoke, as well, he said. And he was able to pry open a door of the metro and go out into the tunnels, and then was able to walk over to the next metro station. Another friend was, this person was on the train behind the train that had the bomb explode. And so it was the same thing. He could also feel the blast, even from the train next to it. So then there was about a 15-minute lag where everyone was just kind of waiting in the dark to see what would happen, and then they were evacuated through the tunnels. All of these people are working in and around the European Union because this is the main station that people working in and around the EU institutions use to commute to work.
You have told me that there's many people still in office buildings, and yet the government has asked them to shelter in place or encourage citizens at least to curb their movements. How do office workers get home?
As far as I'm aware, the metro is still not running. Even if they had started running, now I'm hearing there's possibly a raid in an area just next to the EU quarter. So there may be raids going on in the city, in which case I doubt that they would be opening up the metro. So I'm not sure what people in their office are supposed to do. I know a lot of people who just walked home.
Are there any updates on the number of bombs or the number of people involved?
So the Belgian authorities released a photo from a CCTV image in the airport check-in area. It shows three men. They all have luggage carts. Two of them are wearing gloves on their left hands, which apparently is something that may help them if they were trying to detonate a suicide bomb. It's thought that two bombs went off and a third one did not detonate. And so right now the authorities are looking at the possibility that perhaps all three were meant to be suicide bombers, but the third one, his bomb didn't go off and he may be on the loose.
Now, they did find the third bomb, did they not, and detonated at the airport?
Yes, the authorities discovered the undetonated bomb at the airport after the blast, and they detonated it in a controlled explosion.
That's reporter Dave Keating in Brussels. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle.
Security has been tightened around the world at airports, railway stations, and government buildings. Hundreds of flights have been cancelled, and trains heading for Brussels have been stopped. Among the reaction to today's terrorist attack in Brussels, President Obama says the U.S. will do whatever is necessary to assist Belgian authorities in bringing those responsible to justice. Also, EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini broke down in tears after hearing the news. She said it was a very sad day for Europe. She blamed the attack on radicalization. And Pope Francis called the attack blind violence and expressed his deepest sympathy.
Partial results from Niger's presidential runoff election show incumbent Mahamadou Issoufou heading for a landslide victory. According to Reuters, Niger's Electoral Commission says Mr. Issoufou has received 93% of the vote, with about 75% of the constituencies counted. The commission put voter turnout at 61%. The opposition, which had called for a boycott of Sunday's poll, said the results are not credible. A VOA reporter in Niger on Sunday reported low voter turnout across the country.
The deal between the European Union and Turkey to control the flow of migrants and refugees into Europe continues to encounter problems. The mayor of the Greek island of Lesbos tells Sky News that there is confusion over the plan. He says there are no clear directions on how to implement it. Mayor Galinos says the decision was rushed because EU policymakers dragged their feet for a year and a half. Tens of thousands of migrants and refugees are in Greece. The overcrowded camp at Idomene has been getting much attention, but the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders is setting up new, smaller camps and hotspot registration centers have opened, which are supposed to ease the situation. Among the reporters following developments in Greece is Mariana Karloulaki. She tells VOA's Jody Capua about a protest yesterday in Idomeni.
So yesterday around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, hundreds of refugees blocked the train line, so the train stopped for the whole day. And they started protesting. It was mainly young men and children, and some women as well. They were protesting for open borders. And they were from various nationalities, not only Syrians and Iraqis, but also from Pakistan and from Afghanistan. The protest was on until 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and at some point around 8:30 or 9 o'clock, one man tried to set himself on fire, but he was stopped by other refugees. Apart from this incident, it was generally quite peaceful. And it was quite odd that some refugees tried to break the police blockade, but the majority stopped them. So in a way, they were protecting the police and they didn't want any serious incidents to happen.
Now, I know they're making new camps in Idomeni. Have you been able to go see what those new camps are like?
In Idomeni, yes, because it's an open camp. It's a trans camp. The MSF has set up some new tents. The camps that are not accessible to journalists are those that are in Thessaloniki, which is 70 kilometers from Idomeni. The known hotspots where refugees go there and can start the procedure for asylum, either in the European Union or in Greece. These camps are controlled by the army, so this might be one of the reasons that journalists are not allowed in. Another reason is that generally the police and the army think that journalists are those that cause refugees to cause trouble, so we're not allowed to get in. It's quite difficult.
Now, you're in Thessaloniki. Has that city been affected at all by the migrant crisis?
It has been affected, but not now. It was affected last May when refugees arrived and stayed in the parks. The past couple of days, we have the first ferries that arrive in the city from the port of Kavala. These are ferries with refugees and migrants from the islands, and they're being transported directly to Thessaloniki and go to the hotspots, to the refugee camps, where they can apply for asylum.
Can you tell us what goes on at the hotspots?
From volunteers that have been in there, they told me that the facilities are quite nice. And refugees can stay there until their asylum application is being processed. Basically, they can stay there for 6 months. This is how long they are allowed to stay in Greece with the papers that they get from the island, where refugees can apply for the EU relocation program, where they will apply for asylum in the European Union or for asylum in Greece. They will start the procedure there.
What has been the reaction from the migrants and refugees that you've spoken with or met with to the recent agreement between the European Union and Turkey?
Actually, before the agreement, they were expecting the borders to open. Every single one told me that, oh, we're expecting this to happen and we're finally going to be able to go to Germany or Europe. But after the agreement, complete desperation. They have finally realized that the borders have completely closed.
That's reporter Mariana Karloulaki in Greece. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Also, many thousands of migrants and refugees have landed on the Greek island of Lesbos after a treacherous water crossing from nearby Turkey. They were picked up by UN Refugee Agency buses and brought to the town of Moria to register for temporary visas. Since November, many have been given dry clothes, hot meals, and a tent at the Better Days for Moria camp. It's a former olive grove next door to the official registration station run entirely by volunteers. In part two of our series on life at the camp, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke earlier this year with a young American who oversees one of its 8-hour shifts.
Darkness falls on the Better Days for Moria camp, bringing freezing temperatures with it. Still, a momentary peace has settled here, and migrants are regrouping after their just-completed journeys. Some are enjoying their first hot meal in weeks, while others warm themselves at an olive wood fire burning in one of the oil drums scattered about, and sing a song from home. Meanwhile, 28-year-old Jack Ferguson is just beginning his 8-hour shift, coordinating 15 or so volunteers from nearly 10 countries. They'll be welcoming new busloads of migrants, manning the dry clothing distribution tent, the medical clinic, the kitchen, and this 24-hour hot tea stall. Volunteers also offer blankets and answer questions about the 3 to 4 day official registration process for temporary visas. Ferguson says he does between 10 and 20 laps around Moria on each shift.
I'm looking for any problems that I can solve immediately or that need me to solve them. Otherwise, I look for somebody who I can tell them how to solve it, and then I can move on. So, say I walk down to the lower registration line, and there is no Arabic translator there, and the police are shouting at them and pushing them with the riot shields. My job is to very quickly get 6 volunteers simply to be a presence and form a line, and then also to get one of our Arabic translators, if they're on site, down there. At that point, what the translator is doing is assuring the police that there is somebody who can talk to the refugees so that the police start to calm down. As soon as the police start to calm down, we can start to do our work, which is to form the line.
Ferguson says the Greek police lack many supplies, including, for example, police tape.
So if I were to run up here and get those volunteers and the Arabic translator, I would also come up here and get police tape, which we've bought and we have in the storeroom. And I would run back down there and start to string up police tape in lines and then move people into those lines. A completely different example would be I come across a family who they have been separated. Half of the family, the mother and the 2 small children, went into registration, but the father and the baby were, for whatever reason, separated from the family at the time. They were going to the bathroom, or the father went to the tent to change the baby, and that family is inside, and I need to get them inside, which is a whole discussion with the police.
Sounds like dealing with the police is a big aspect of what you do.
A successful day here for us is a day when the police don't come out and have any interaction with the refugees.
The police rarely come over to the Better Days for Moria site itself, where Jack and most of the other volunteers work. Unlike the official family and registration compound of Moria, where NGOs, the UN, the European Union, and the Greek government are in control, Better Days sits on private land that its founders have rented for services others do not adequately provide. One never knows just when a group of migrants will arrive, wet, hungry, in need of sleep or medicine. Ferguson says the near chaos can be baffling to new volunteers who usually know about the migrant situation only from news reports.
Everybody sees the picture of somebody running into the waves and grabbing the boat, lifting the child off the boat. That is the face of this crisis. It's not people shivering in -2 degrees without blankets or shelter. That happens 24 hours after the thing that everyone thinks of as this crisis. It's not people in dirty, unserviced bathrooms. It's not the 3 times a week miscarriages that we have here that the doctors are dealing with.
Part of Ferguson's job is to offer volunteers advice on how to cope.
First of all, I counsel patience and a certain degree of introspection so that the volunteers don't turn into a negative aspect of the camp as well. It requires all of your forbearance to sit with the situation and watch it as it evolves instead of trying to pounce on it. And when you are reactive, that's a very good sign that you need some time off.
Ferguson encourages his volunteers to take 10 or 15 minutes a day to simply sit down and breathe, get a cup of hot tea, or take a walk. He especially recommends sharing some conversation with the migrants, preferably one-to-one. Doing so helps newcomers feel that someone cares about them personally, but it also helps volunteers to recharge emotionally and to get back in touch with why they chose to volunteer in the first place.
I think everybody comes here because they want to reaffirm for others and for themselves a shared aspect of humanity. They want to stand up and say that we all count. And talking to somebody and hearing about their life, hearing the names of their family, hearing them talk about either their trip or just their house before they left, the sorts of possessions that they had, how their tone of voice changes when they talk about the motorcycle they had, that feels like having the experience you came here to have, a personal connection with the refugees.
Jack Ferguson believes that migrants' first experiences on Lesbos can create vast ripple effects for good or for ill. If they're treated with suspicion or cruelty, it creates painful memories and wounds that can lead to radicalization down the road. Kindness has the opposite effect. In that sense, he says, compassion is good security policy, not just a humanitarian goal. Adam Phillips, VOA News, on Lesbos, Greece.
Thank you, Adam. And you can hear part 3 of our series on migrants and refugees tomorrow on Africa News Tonight.
UN-backed Presidential Council for Libya has said there is enough support for a government of national unity despite opposition from hardliners in 2 competing parliaments. The 9-member council was formed last December under the Libyan political agreement. In January, it voted to announce a unity government, but the 7-2 vote indicated ongoing divisions on the matter, with critics saying the unity government was pushed through too soon. Among those following developments is Issam Omish, a board member of the Libyan American Public Affairs Council. VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El Shenawi asked him about the chances for a viable unity government in Libya.
Majority of Libyans are very hopeful that the UN-backed agreement, which brought about the Presidential Council, is going to work. Many people see it as Libya's last hope for stability and for our ability to bring the country from the brink of despair. But I think there remain some challenges. Seating it in Tripoli remains a challenge. Getting the full approval of the parliament in a formal constitutional way remains a challenge, despite the 101 members of parliament signing on to a document approving the presidential council's agreement. I think in Tripoli, particularly, despite the fact that there is a large group of members of the General National Congress, as well as members of militias and local leaders who are welcoming the seating of the government in Tripoli, there is a significant opposition remaining in the leadership of the GNC, as well as the Salvation Government, which is the executive body in Tripoli. I think until we work out those details, we remain hopeful that things will move. In fact, as of today, a location has been picked for the seating of the government. And it seems hopeful that people at least will allow the government to enter Tripoli and be there until maybe they work out their last differences with the current government that still is in Tripoli.
Western governments hope a unity government can help tackle the growing threat from ISIS. Would such a government have enough Libyan forces to uproot ISIS?
I think if the Libyans reach a political agreement, I think there is enough forces in the different militias. If they unite behind a government, if they unite behind the existential threat of ISIS in Libya, which is perceived as such, I believe, by the vast majority of Libyans, I think that is possible. I was in communications with some of the political leadership in Tripoli, and after the airstrike in Sabratha by the U.S. forces, they were able to round up close to 3,000 revolutionaries in a matter of a few days. And they took up the fight that cleaned out Sabratha from the forces of ISIS all the way out to the Tunisian border. I believe with the right resources and with the right political leadership, the Libyan people and especially the Libyan revolutionaries, will be able to round up the thousands of forces that are needed to rout ISIS. I think the Libyans see it as an existential threat, and the Libyans see it as threatening their way of life. And so I believe we will have unity behind that purpose.
The U.S. hopes to crush ISIS in Libya, and this hope rests on a unity government that can authorize military intervention. What do Libyans think about international help to fight ISIS?
There's a consensus, no doubt, that they need international help in order for them to be able to fight ISIS. Libyans do. But the majority of opinion in Libya is that people are weary or afraid of direct intervention in the ways of boots on the ground. They much rather see logistical, maybe intelligence, maybe air cover, equipment, weapons, things along those lines in order for them to be able to overcome the threat of ISIS, who are also very difficult militia fighters. So they are very much in need of the international help, and they very much believe it's needed. The unity government will be the condition that the international community has set prior to intervening in Libya, for fear that that may disintegrate the Libyan scene and that may create more chaos than help if there was no unity government and if there was no official capacity that would welcome the international help. But I think if we're talking specifically about would or multinational force be helpful in the Libyan scene, if it's composed of Brits and Italians and French, I believe that's going to be difficult, and I believe that's going to complicate the matter, because that will become a rallying cry for people who oppose Western intervention and who would, in fact, use it as a way to discredit the unity government.
Issam Omish is board member of the Libyan American Public Affairs Council. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. And on behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We will discuss the Benin presidential election. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news? Interviews? Analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com. Africa.